Susan Montanaro, and you're listening to Dreams and Detours, a show about the life we plan to have versus the one we're living, for better or not. Everybody has a story, and I believe we find ourselves in each other's stories. Hello, and welcome to the show. I'm Susan of Dreams and Detours. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking to Adele Anderson, a wellness coach, a destiny coach, a life coach. You'll find that in our conversation, you will learn that Adele has been able to touch upon all aspects of living, happiness, and putting those pieces together in order for you to find your best version. Welcome to the show, Adele.
Thank you so much. I'm really pleased to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy to talk to you. I know that we recently met and we've had a chance to get to know each other a little bit, but this is really very special to me to have the chance to talk to you a little bit more about you and the work and the practice that you have. Just to get started and give a little bit of context to where we're located, where did you grow up, Adele?
I grew up on the west coast of Canada. So in just outside of what's called the Okanagan, which is kind of like our orchards and wine country.
Okay.
But really, it's just a small town in the country, 3 hours from Vancouver. Okay. It was quite a peaceful, non-eventful, but lovely childhood.
Yeah, I imagine it would be. During your upbringing, just to tap into a little bit about who, you know, where you come from, your family, and really who your earliest influencers were for you.
You know, I have a family that's very close. I have to say we did a lot of activities together. I feel like I've thought about my childhood a lot, thinking that, you know, what could have been wrong with it? And, you know, I don't find anything other than I think I was so cared for, I really didn't have to stretch very far.
That's terrific.
So I really felt like I was in the moment. It's funny, I don't have a ton of childhood memories, like lots of people from my early days, you know, they remember school events. And I've thought about that as, you know, as a mind science person, why do I not have these deep sort of memories of my early days? And I almost feel like it's because it was so peaceful that the traumatic events that often get stuck in our mind just didn't exist for me. So I could have been just one of those lucky children, or maybe I was just very in the moment.
That's fantastic. It sort of speaks to what you've just described as the landscape of where you grew up, and very natural, very beautiful, very simple, but yet lovely and charming. So that's a plus. That's a good thing. So we're here today, and you and I have talked about this to dive into and to talk a little bit about the way in which life can suddenly change and the way in which trauma and events from previous lives as well as our earlier, you know, lives impacts us and change us. And since that is the work that you do often with your clients, I thought it would be great, and I know you agree, to start off with the event that kind of changed your life. And that happened for you when you were 27. But before we dive into what that event was, tell me a little bit about what your life looked like in that year or so kind of leading up to 27 years old.
Yeah, 27 is an interesting year for many people because Saturn return, right? We have change in the air. And that year was eventful for me. I had married my childhood sweetheart right out of school, and a lovely, lovely guy. So I'd known him most of my life, and our families were best friends. So the connection was integral to my upbringing. And at 27, I kind of bolted from that relationship. We'd been married for, I guess, 8 years, because I got married when I was 19. But I was feeling unfulfilled. And it wasn't because my marriage wasn't charmed. It was because I wasn't doing things for myself. I know that now, but I had that feeling like I just couldn't be where I was. And so I leaped. And I leaped into the unknown.
Okay. That's what people do when they suddenly wake up and realize they have to go. Had you been working, and had you been in a particular career path and field of choice at that point?
Yeah, I wasn't. I was working for the bank. I had fun. It was easy. My husband went back to university early. He was getting his science degree, and then he actually went off and became a vet. But with that, I was waiting for him, or that was the plan, is I would wait for him to finish university, and then it would be my turn. So I felt like a little bit like I was treading water, that I was waiting for something to start, and I got restless.
Okay, that happens. So here you are, you're 27, as you said, it's a pivotal time, and you make this leap out of your marriage, relatively with quietly, or was it an abrupt departure? Was it surprising to all parties involved, including your families?
It was surprising because, we'd been together since we were kids. Our families were best friends. Okay. It meant that I was on my own for the very first time in my life. I went from my father and mom's house to, my husband. I'd never been alone. I had never experienced life alone. So that was a big step for me. And I realized that I like being surrounded by people. So this was outside of my comfort level, but not enough to not have me make the change.
Okay. Did you leave the area entirely, or was it just a function of, I just need my own space, but I'm sticking around?
Yeah, we were still in the same city, but then he left to another province to where he would get his veterinary certification. So he was leaving the province very close to that time.
Okay, so your life is starting to recreate in itself. You're independent on your own for the very first time in your own space. And how long after your marriage ended and you had found this new sense of independence did things suddenly change and now take me into that next place?
When I first left, I stayed with a girlfriend in her apartment, and we were down sunbathing on the green area of her apartment building, and this man came down and he said, don't want to interrupt you girls. He was kind of loud and brash and kind of like a bad boy. And he just said, I've got a couple planes, I got a couple boats. You guys want to go out one of these days? And I kind of thought, I knew at the time that I was punishing myself. But I'd left a marriage with such a lovely person, who would never have abused me in any way. And here's this sort of guy who I'd never really been in contact with, that type of individual before. Not to say he was all bad, but
he was a character.
he is a character. And I said, yeah, I'll jump in your boat. I'll jump in your plane. Because it was a bit risky. Mm-hmm. And I almost felt like I had done something wrong and I needed to punish myself in some way. Like I had that realization that I needed to pay penance mm-hmm. in some way.
And so you felt kind of being risky and making a decision that you knew was not a quality decision would be part of that retribution you were paying potentially.
Yeah. And I was tired of eating macaroni without the cheese.
There you go.
we had been like starving students, just barely making ourselves by. And it was fine. We don't need much. If we really think about it, life was actually fine. But I hadn't had a feeling like I've been treated recently. And I know that sounds shallow, but my husband at the time, he was so dedicated to becoming a student or becoming a vet. He needed the grades. This was sort of like going back to school as an adult. And so there wasn't a lot of time for us. And I guess I felt deprived in some way. Mm-hmm. And no fault of his, it was just something that I recognize now, that I felt like something was missing in my life.
Okay, fair enough. So here you are, you've now met this interesting, colorful character who's kind of entertaining you and dangling a few, supercharged items like a boat and a plane in front of you and kind of entertaining the idea of, hey, come along with me for this ride. Was it pretty quick that you went along for a ride, and was it his adventure up into the sky that changed your life?
Yes, it was. I did go into, you know, it was summer at the point, so went out for a couple boat rides. It was fun. You know, he had material wealth, so we'd go up for dinner and he would say, oh, don't order off the menu. I'll just order the menu.
Right.
And then you can pick and choose what you want. Because
right.
It was almost like he was like, you know, I'd never tasted sushi. I'd never had this. I'd never have that. And he's like, oh, I'm going to have her experience all of these things. And he would watch me mm-hmm. and he would find joy in that. It's kind of like taking a kid to Disneyland.
Sure.
And sure. And he was generous that way. So, you know, no fault of him, but it was kind of like I was in Disneyland.
Fantastic. Okay. So let's fast forward to the day of your life-changing event. Where were you headed? Who were you traveling with?
Yeah, I was with him in a small plane, and we were just out for, I think it was a Sunday afternoon. It was a beautiful sunny day. There was another small plane traveling with us. I think we had dropped into the States for a lunch. And I remember the waitress coming by and she said, can I get you anything else? And he said, no, we got to fly. And then we walked across the street, got in the plane and started heading back to the Vancouver area to the airport where the plane would be parked.
How long of a trip would that be?
It was probably a day, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours in total.
Mm-hmm.
Or it should have been that long. We've been on several trips like that where it was just an afternoon
mm-hmm.
out. You have to kind of go with how much gas you had. Mm-hmm. And that was just another sunny day.
So your return trip home was about an hour's trip up in the sky to return. And so
it was the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I remember something that was quite beautiful. The plane that we were traveling side by side with, they were just, if you think of a clock, they were like 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking out at them and the sun was going down and they passed between the sun and us and they turned into a silhouette.
Gorgeous.
Kind of like,
gorgeous.
So it was just one of those moments where you think, oh my God, you know, the sky is red and here's this plane that just turned black in front of my eyes.
It was right. That's lovely. So, okay. So when did you notice the things, or did things go wrong very quickly, or how did that happen? Was it any warning, or?
There was no warning. We were flying over a river, Pitt River, mm-hmm. and he indicated to me, we were wearing headphones, and he indicated to me by pointing, but also by speaking, that he wanted to go down and do a little skip off the water. So in plain lingo, it's called skip and go, which meant he would just scoot down to the river, so dive quite quickly, and then he'd allow his amphibious plane, he had pontoons, to hit the surface of the water. The plane would skip off the water and then, you know, scoot back up into the sky.
Okay.
I felt the plane drop. You know, I felt us pummeling towards the earth without a care in the world.
Because he advised you, this is what we're going to do. And so you're like, go for it. Let's do it.
Yeah. And there was really it was one of those perfect sunny days. You know, there's you're probably from a warmer part of the world, but for us, when the breeze is balmy going through your hair and across your skin is a rare day here. It's always a little bit cooler.
Okay.
And it was one of those perfect days where the wind, you know, wafting across your face. And, you know, you could feel your cheeks wobbling with the force of the plane moving.
Right, right.
But it was just one of those days where it was, beauty was all around us.
So was it that absolute moment when you went down that things did not go as planned?
It was a moment in time.
Tell me about that. I'm going to let you tell that story now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he didn't realize that he had left the landing gear down. The landing gear sit below the pontoon, so you can't visibly see them. And so when these wheels struck the surface of the water, it flipped us immediately. And it flipped us so fast that I saw him, we went from nose to tail. So I saw him go under first, and you know, our subconscious brain works really, really fast. And so I realized that we were going under, and I went to take a breath of air and my mouth filled with water. So there I was, upside down in water. It was black. It was cold. We were swirling in the current. I had no air and I had a mouthful of water. So the first thing I decided to do was to swallow rather than to exhale, to just keep as much oxygen in my body as I possibly could. And then I realized I was trapped. It was confusing. It had happened really, you know, instantly. And there was sort of junk in the cabine. There were gas cans and seatbelt ties, and we were in an amphibious plane, so we were wearing life jackets. So the tug of that and those straps also were all tangled. And I remember specifically, like, I had really long hair at the time. I could feel my hair dragging through my eyes. You know, I would try to open my eyes to see, but you know what it looks like when someone's in the water, your hair is just
swirling.
Swirling, right? And I could feel these fibers of my hair moving through my eyes, and it just, there is so many details that were so infinite. But there I was. I tried to push off. I, you know, could feel my feet thump on that floor of that plane, and then the harness, you know, digging into my shoulders. I was pinned. And then I could feel, you know, you probably, if you ever swam underwater in a pool, you try to go really, really far. You feel the energy leave your limbs. And that's what I started to experience. I'd been a lifeguard forever, so I really was comfortable in the water, but I knew that feeling of, okay, I need to get up. And it wasn't happening. And at that point, I did have that thought go through my brain for the first time that, I wonder if I'm going to die. And as soon as I said that, my life began to flash in front of my eyes. Millions and millions of images from the moment of my birth, and it actually went through my death. I had a vision inside my mind's eye of the local police force, a couple of officers walking through my parents' front yard, up their big red brick stairs, and then knocking on this big old wooden door. I watched them, you know, open the door, my parents facing the RCMP officers, and first being surprised or curious or, you know, wondering why they were there. And then I could see the conversation unravel because their expressions began to change. And it was at that point that my mom collapsed, and she screamed. And she screamed so loud inside my head that I snapped myself back into my reality. And I think back into my body, because I remember separating and sort of watching myself very passively below. But it was that moment that I made a choice that I wasn't going to die that day. I wasn't going to allow that to happen. I wasn't going to put my parents through that. And I was getting out of the plane, and I was getting out of it now. And you have to understand, there was nothing different from that one thought to the next. I was still trapped.
Right.
But remarkably, by making that choice, it changed my perception of anything that was possible. So all of those images that had been flashing forward began to go in reverse, just like an old time ticker tape movie, like one flash, 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 flash. And it went back through millions and millions of images, and then it stopped. And it stopped on a scene of a movie that I'd watched decades before. I didn't know the name of the movie or the actors or the scenes that came before or the ones that would follow, but the image right in front of my eyes gave me all the information I needed to escape a plane that had crashed and overturned in water. And it was a commander training young pilots how to escape a plane that had crashed and overturned in water. And I literally followed the script. You know, I followed his commands of how to find the three-point harness release hatch, how to get out of the harness, how to push myself deeper into the water in order to escape the cage of the plane. And then gravity took over, and I, you know, I came up to the surface, and I broke that surface of the water, and you know, took that first painful breath. But it was remarkable, and I was almost high. I remember I jumped up onto the pontoons and I threw my arms in the air like an Olympian and I yelled, "Yes!" I was so adrenaline was really, really pumping. And then my next moment, I was back in the water trying to dive for the pilot.
Okay. Wow. Wow. I think the biggest wow part, aside from the fact that you experienced what you did and the way in which things came up and then went back down, was that victory moment that you were able to experience immediately upon saving yourself, like in the real world, saving yourself with oxygen.
Wow. Yeah, it was a powerful experience. And it really was, you know, nothing that you want to ever experience at home. Don't do it.
Nope, don't try this.
but it was exhilarating. Okay. And then it was exhausting.
Of course, of course. Did your pilot friend make it?
He did. I dove, I believe, three different times to try to find him. But you have to realize the sun had gone down. So right. We were on a pitch black river in a pitch black sky. And the only thing that was really visible were the upside down pontoons. Okay. And he did come up. Three dives. You got to think that does take a little bit of time for you to dive in the water, try to figure out what to do, come back up for air, get back on the pontoons, dive again, you know. But he came up and he came up vomiting. So he was to the point where he was taking water in. Mm-hmm. The system. But he did survive. And it was quite amazing. It took him, he couldn't get out of the water. He was so exhausted. He just clung to the side of the pontoons.
Okay. Okay. So that changed everything for you, clearly. tell me about what that, then the trajectory that your life would now go on based on this complete shift, because, you know, having an experience where you pretty much die and then rebirth, I think it's fair to probably describe it that way. All of a sudden changes everything.
Yeah, I believe I went to the other side. Mm-hmm. There was certain aspects of things that I believe now to be true. I don't think that I had a true realization of the impact it would have on my life then. I probably was in shock. We were hypothermic by the time we were able to find the very limited traffic that was still on the river at that time of night. A boat finally came by and collected us. It was well past midnight by then. I remember we hailed a cab and, you know, we'd been soaking wet for hours. And I was hypothermic, I believe. I remember getting into a bath and just the gas coming off of my hair and just being that stone cold feeling. And yet the next morning I went to work.
Oh boy. Oh my goodness.
I didn't tell anybody. I don't know if I thought I was going to be in trouble or what the process was within my mind. But truthfully, I never really spoke about it for about 25 years.
So you have an experience like that. You find your way to dry ground. You dry yourself off. And this is not about going to an emergency room. This is not about being checked out. This is not about police coming to us, almost like a crime scene. This is, you just walked away.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's what I thought would happen, is that we'd be in trouble in some way. I don't know. I mean, the plane had to be towed and then, you know, dug out of the water, which happened, I guess, the next day. I had nothing really on, that wasn't on my docket, but he did sell the plane after that.
Of course. So you go back to living your life.
Yeah, definitely were moments that I knew that I would never take life for granted again. Like I remember, I don't even know how long I slept, but because I saw the sunrise and I remember crying, thinking I would never see that again.
Yeah.
So there was lots of firsts
Oh boy. Yeah, that has to be, right? Even all this time later, a complete, whew.
Yeah, there was lots of things that changed my life that way, like not to have any more regrets or just to appreciate, to smell the roses.
Right.
You know, everything I saw, like the first baby that I saw after that, or it didn't matter whose baby it was.
Right. It was life in a way that you hadn't really thought or looked at before.
I think I became aware for the first time. I think it was opening myself to really being conscious.
Right. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
We are no longer just living in our own bubble with ourselves. We're actually realizing our connection to life and to others and to this world that we're in.
And that's a new thought for me. So thank you for putting me through this process. But I believe that's what it was.
Right.
I became acutely aware of what was happening around me and how that impacted me personally, and how it just was an amazing experience to be here.
I've been reading a lot from others who, you know, go in and out of transitional times in their lives. And one woman stated it as, when something shuts down and has trauma associated with it, to look at it as an invitation into this growth and into this incredibly new space in life, it can sometimes make it make sense. So perhaps totally. That was your invitation to be alive, to be living.
I think I have a purpose on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we resist our purpose, we still move towards it.
Right.
If we are at least open to it. And I think that was a turning point to me. It was like, no, you're not ready to die yet. You are meant to be here and you have a purpose. So it still took me another decade.
That's okay. So then let's talk about that. So it would take another decade for you to, for you to start diving into the wellness aspect of the work you wanted to do, both for yourself and for others?
Yeah, very shortly around that time, I became an entrepreneur rather than working for someone else. I worked for myself. And with that, there was, of course, a lot of demands, lots of very long hours. So that whole transition for me was huge. My family was always in the entrepreneurial range, so it wasn't like it was out of my radar, but it was still new to me. And with that, too, I met someone who became very influential in my life, my girlfriend Anna, who passed away at the age of 52. Troubled, beautiful soul, who taught me a lot about spirituality. And she was the one that first engaged me into being more conscious or more aware of things outside of the physical world.
Okay, that's brilliant. So that tapped into a part of yourself that was ready or open to it, obviously, willing to go there.
Not quite ready.
No?
Not quite ready. You know, I had this, and I still do find myself trapped in that belief system where science is the only way.
Okay.
And even though I know that that's not true anymore, because I'm a homeopath, so, you know, I'm in that area where people judge what homeopathy is all about, and yet quantum physics does explain it. But so often we look for the scientific community to give us validation, and I found myself in that thought process as well when it came to spirituality or inner growth in a way that wasn't really tangible in, you know, I go to work, right. I do this particular thing.
Right.
I receive an income for that.
Right.
Where, you know, personal growth or spirituality has maybe that intangibleness to it, which I know now is so tangible to our happiness.
Absolutely.
Finding our life purpose. That's but right. I wasn't quite there yet.
Okay.
I was having moments of awareness, which would pique my curiosity.
Okay.
But it wasn't how I grew up.
Right. So it wasn't, yeah, okay, that makes complete sense. And if you weren't at a stage where you were ready to sort of open up that part of yourself to indulge it and to understand it or just to remain curious, then, right, you can listen and maybe be entertained to some degree by the person, this woman that came into your life. So talk to me about how you're an entrepreneur, your field is restaurants, you're running restaurants, you're spending a lot of time there. Clearly, if this was if the accident was a story you had not shared immediately, you certainly weren't doing that at this point. As you've mentioned, it took you 25 years to do that. So you're in a busy career running your own businesses, and it's kind of keeping things tidy emotionally, if you would want to call it that, because it's contained.
Yeah. I mean, we are what we focus on, right?
And for sure.
When we're doing a busy entrepreneurial life, our minds are very busy with what we're doing. You know, I had, I don't know, 50 or 60 employees. We were doing $8,000 a day. We took it from $400 a day up to $8,000 a day. So we were really, really popular. And I think people came because of the people that worked with us.
Right.
You know, we had cousins and we had aunts and uncles, and my mom and dad came on board, and we hired brothers and sisters and partners, and it was really a family affair, and we had such fun, and I met some of my greatest friends through that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing also that I was working an average of 17 hours a day, there's not much time for anything outside of work.
Right.
You were feet on the floor for, you know, 17 hours a day.
Right. Well, at least like your description of that, at least it sounds like it's a really rich existence, because you have your family and your closest relatives around, and that's nurturing. You're working really hard, but you're working really hard in a very loving, it sounds like, and giving and nurturing environment, even on the bad days, you know, it was overall positive.
Totally. I still have some of my best friends or people that started out working for me. And, you know, family, of course, we were always close.
Right.
The restaurant was a fabulous experience. It was high octane. It was fun. It was a lot of hard work.
I bet. So then,
and it was nurturing people. We were feeding people. I realized that is the part of the journey. It took me a while to figure that out. Like, what would be it about a restaurant that would really satisfy me? And we were taking care of people.
Yes.
We would literally tell them, you've got to go home. You can't be here every day. I'm, you know, you have to go home. I don't want to see you till Monday. These would be clients. You really have to go spend time with your family. You can't be here.
Right. That's fantastic. But look, I mean, again, and you created a nurturing environment, and here you are doing, yes, it's a very symbolic gesture, even though you're in business, you're feeding people, and you're feeding them to the degree where they just want to be there and present with you. So let's talk a little bit about that spiritual element that you may not have been ready or quite open to yet, but it was all around you and it was existing, and everyone was exuding it on some level because your clients just wanted to be there with you. So, you know, it was growing. You were watering it daily, even if you weren't aware of it. It was already happening. Those plants were popping up left and right, the spiritual ones, that is. So those connections were being made, even if you couldn't see them, you could feel them.
Totally. Yeah. There were moments of flow.
Yeah.
Right? Where you just lose track of time. You know, the idea of flow, meaning you're really in tune with what you're focused on. It's challenging, and yet time doesn't really exist, which
right.
is an element of spirituality, of moving towards your purpose. And some of it was probably exhaustion.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. So then what led you to get into the wellness sector and to do the work of the naturopath?
Yeah. The same fellow who was in the plane crash with me, he was my landlord. And originally he was my business partner. When we broke up, he, you know, took that all away because I was a minor shareholder. And so my parents actually mortgaged their house for me and they became my business partners, okay. Which is really remarkable when I think about it. But within a short year, I paid my parents back other than $10,000. I was part of the reason why I was working such long hours. I needed to make sure that our family home was okay. Mm-hmm. And then my lease came due. When we had paid him the money for this restaurant, he had said, even though he had partners, he owned 52% of the shares of where the restaurant sat within a marina that they owned. And he had said that he would vote for us to have a lease renewal. Mm-hmm. But when it came down to it, we were making so much money, they decided to take it over. And we took them to court, and the judge had said to me, well, it may be immoral, but it's not illegal. And you have 7 days to vacate.
Wow. So you paid him off in terms of the business partnership aspect. You bought him out, but then he really ended up getting it all back in the end anyway. Oh, wow. What?
It was painful at the time. You know, I was angry.
Of course.
But really, it was a blessing.
Always is. Always is. You know, we don't know until later, but it is.
I didn't see it at the time, but I had started a relationship with my current husband, love of my life, and he was moving to where we live now, which is called the Sunshine Coast. Mm-hmm. And this was all sort of stuff that wasn't really in my radar right now, but, you know, I felt broken. I felt angry. I felt, you know, all
betrayed, no doubt. You were betrayed. Yeah. Look, you didn't want to be in the relationship. So then he revoked everything. That's betrayal, you know?
Yeah. So it was a difficult time emotionally for me. Mm-hmm. And then my fiance, my current husband, got scared because I was going to move up to the coast, and he pulled the plug on our marriage. So in the same week that I lost my restaurant, he kind of,
he got cold feet.
Cold feet.
So we must have been in that, like, what is going on here, right?
Yeah. I really felt like I was drowning.
Right. Yeah, again.
Use that. Yeah.
I felt like drowning.
Yeah. Interesting. And so one of the girls that worked for me, who's one of my dear friends, she said to me, why don't you go to Thailand? Why don't you just pack up and mm-hmm. leave the country? Mm-hmm. Do something completely different. You've never done it. And here's a person who had been on her own, like, very little. And I did. Within probably 7 days of losing the restaurant, losing my fiance, I was on a plane to Thailand.
Roughly how old are you at this point?
35.
Okay. 36. Okay. Okay. So you up and go. Not the first time that you've felt the need to go, boom, boom, I'm out. I need to rediscover me. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I landed in Thailand with a knapsack on my back, couldn't speak the language, couldn't read the road signs, mm-hmm. had not a clue what to do. Mm-hmm. And it was quiet.
Yeah. You probably needed a little bit of that.
It was quiet. And so this became the missing connection to my spirituality, because I was forced to be in my body by myself.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And feel the uncomfortableness.
That's right.
And listen to those voices in my head that I didn't like.
That's right. You now had nothing but time and yourself to let it all come up and out and make sense of it. How long did you spend in Thailand?
I was there 4 months.
Okay.
And, you know, I got introduced to Buddhism for the first time.
Okay.
You know, I would trek through crazy forests and fields and come across dark-skinned men carrying machetes, and I had not a care in the world. I visited ashrams. I volunteered at orphanages. I learned to meditate. I took a yoga course. And I felt free for the first time in my entire life. Wow. I was so comfortable. I had no stress in my body, which I probably didn't recognize that. I recognized when it came back in.
Well, you didn't recognize that you ever had it until you didn't.
Exactly. We become enormous. Numb to it. It becomes normalized.
That's right.
So that was fascinating. And one of the most powerful meditations I ever had was in this ashram. And I remember she had this huge painting on the wall and it was orange and white. And it was one of those circle, 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 all the way into the little dot. So mm-hmm. it made your eyes do these funny things. And she took me on a visualization meditation and she took me to Nirvana where I touched the face of God. And I was there for hours. It was only supposed to be, you know, a 1 hour, but it took me a long time to come out, which seemed to be the way with me with other spiritual experiences where, you know, 1 hour would actually be timelessness and would be 7 hours. But the experience that happened when I left the ashram was I was on a big sort of thoroughway. There was at least 4 lanes of traffic with a medium in between. And I was just walking alone back to the ashram and people started crossing the highway to touch me.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. And I had no problem with that. I didn't think it was strange. I would just stand very quietly and they would come up and they would put their hands on my shoulder, on my neck, on my arms. The energy coming off of me, I believe, was pure love, which I believe is our natural human state, which is often
I agree.
In us. But that was, again, an experience that I'll never forget, is this unspoken form of communication between human beings. They were somehow drawn to me.
They could see you were illuminating in some way. And they were just, they had to, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. That's special.
It was really special. And it lasted for about a week and then it was gone. The memory of it wasn't gone, but the aspect of people being drawn to me mm-hmm. at that time, then I started taking a 6-week Thai massage course. Mm-hmm. And then I was around like-minded people, you know, travelers was easy energy.
Right.
And doing something physical, learning something new. Again, it was a form of meditation, which I know now it's very, very meditative to be a practitioner as well as to receive massage. So imagine doing that for 6 weeks. That's all you do for 8 hours a day.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Super. Yeah. I love that. I mean, I'm totally into that and I see value and I see the inherent spiritual qualities there. So yeah, I think that's just amazing. Truly. Yeah. So
I flew home. Back to reality.
Back to reality. But you know, look, I mean, you know, you had your own version of some might refer to as the eat, pray, love dynamic. You went off to find the quiet inside yourself by finding it outside first to let it all unfold. And you were able to do that. And then some, obviously. So you return back to Canada, back home.
I do. My parents are away. Most of my good friends are off traveling or doing something. Mm-hmm. And so my ex-fiance, he asks if he can pick me up. And I thought I'd be okay because I thought, I'm okay.
Right.
You know, it's going to be fine. Right. But he saw me and he said it was like being hit in the stomach and he went down on his knees and he brought out a ring and told me he'd made the worst mistake in his life and would I marry him. And I didn't accept right then because I was like, whoa.
Sure.
I'd been in another planet for a while. And this was not only a surprise to me, But I wasn't in love at that point again. So it was interesting. And then we actually went, he took me home to the property, which is, you know, a beautiful spot. And it is very carefree here in a way, but I felt stress entering my body again for the first time. And it was extremely uncomfortable. It was hard not to notice.
Okay. So how, but that's brilliant, because you hadn't up until that point had the opportunity or the knowledge to differentiate necessarily, because when you keep going and keep going and life just keeps throwing things at you, you keep catching that with all that, those magic gloves. And so that's fascinating. How did you assimilate back into life at home, and what was your now your new road and pathway forward? Like, what did you feel you had a responsibility to do now moving forward? Because I imagine, if not to the rest of the world, but certainly to yourself, having all of this new enlightenment, there's a responsibility that you have to live in a certain way and treat yourself kindly in a certain way.
Yeah. I continued doing meditation. I continued doing yoga every morning. I needed a job. So there's always that aspect of, you know, our culture. We need to pay the bills and yep, get back at it. So I did find a position at a local resort. Friends owned that and they were thrilled to have me. I worked there for about a year, and then it wasn't enough for me because I'd been an entrepreneur for so long. And so then I decided I'd go to Vancouver and go back to school. And I became a homeopath. It took me 4 years. And during that time, I had still owned a condo in Whistler. So I commuted to Whistler and I worked in a local spa. I brought Thai massage to Whistler as the first practitioner there to do that. So I was again with like-minded people in the spa world. I was with like-minded people in the homeopath world, which homeopathy has a very deep spiritual culture to it.
Right.
You know, it body, mind, and soul connection.
Absolutely.
And so that for me, it just made so much sense. I saw the power in it. We had, you know, people who were, they always came as the last resort. That seems to be the way. They've tried everything the Western world has to offer and they're about to die. And then they come and
try to find a homeopath. Save their lives.
And we save their lives. Yeah. So, you know, that to me, it just became so rewarding.
Right.
So I you know, I hung my shingle and couldn't make a living. So again, I needed a job. And being the entrepreneur, I saw the missing links in the marketplace in Whistler, and I started marketing the GMs of local hotels up there, the Pan Pacific, the Delta, an independent hotel called the Sundial,
okay,
the Hilton, and I ended up with 7 spas.
Okay.
So then I thought it was going to be a holistic situation. I'd bring homeopathy, I'd bring wholeness and wellness to this new business of mine, but I had 100 employees.
Wow.
I became very busy.
Right. In the business aspect of it, I would imagine you're busy now in the business aspect of it, as opposed to the service oriented and one-to-one dynamic that you really had been training for and were you receive a gift every time you give. So that exchange in and of itself is the work, but that's not what you're doing. That wasn't what you were doing.
I guess I was doing it a different way because I had 100 people, and when you're managing people, mm-hmm, there's lots of problems, right?
Right.
and they have their lives, which have lots of problems. So right. I became the mentor. I was, you know, there to offer the knowledge that I had. I remember, you know, one lady in particular who's, again, still friends of mine, she had suffered from cancer and was a survivor of breast cancer. But with lots of people that have had life-threatening diseases, what I recognized as a holistic practitioner is They have a need to control their environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'd lost control of their bodies.
That's right.
Right? So they have this great need to control what they can, which makes it maybe a little bit difficult to work with them.
Right. Well, it's very hard to be collaborative when someone is very stuck on a certain, and it's very specific because like you said, it can't be all these other parts. I don't have that, but I have this. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was able to help illuminate, bring awareness to that type of healing. And just this particular gal having the awareness of why she was doing the things that she was doing, mm-hmm. made a difference. And so I did realize I was helping in some way, but I wasn't really sure if I was helping myself.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. It's very important to keep your eye and your consciousness on that. So just to sort of color the situation, at this point, you're working for a variety of different resorts. You're living out of the Whistler location. Did you end up bringing your husband with you and settling in and getting married to him at that stage? Had that occurred?
Okay. We were married at that
okay.
point.
Okay.
So we also had a home on the Sunshine Coast,
okay.
and I would commute there on the weekends.
Okay.
He ended up getting very, very sick.
Okay.
And he was hospitalized for a few months.
Okay.
And so that was a bit of a change for us as well. He did recover, and he actually recovered because of homeopathy.
Okay.
It was a beautiful thing in a way that everything that they tried at, you know, a teaching hospital wasn't working,
right.
and he was really failing. And this head of endocrinology, or forget what his title was, but he was sort of a head teacher mm-hmm. at this hospital. And he came up to me, he says, "I see you have a lot of homeopathic books." And I said, "Yes, I'm a student of homeopathy." He said, "I want you to come down to the MRI room. I want to show you some things." And so he took me down there. And he showed me the pictures of Willis's pancreas and how it was the size of a football, and it should be like the size of a, I don't know, ping pong ball.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, he looked pregnant. He looked 9 months pregnant. And he said to me, when I went to university, he said, my roommate, who is a doctor, he did not stay with Western medicine. He became a homeopath. And because I respect him, I must respect homeopathy, because I know that he is a brilliant guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he took me out into the hallway, and I'll never forget this. He put one arm on either side of my shoulders, and he pushed me against the wall. And he came very, very close to my face, and he said, "If you guys have something, you need to do it now, because
wow.
they're going to take this pancreas out in 7 days."
Wow.
And that changes his life forever.
Right.
So I said, okay, because usually you have to have written consent to work within a hospital. I've done it many times. So I went to the school, and Lori Dack, who was one of our, she's a brilliant homeopath, but she was my, one of my teachers. And I said, "Lori, this is what I think Willis needs." And she goes, is he in the, like they had him in the AIDS ward, because mm-hmm. it needed one-on-one nursing. He was really, really close to death. There were people being pulled out of that room every day. There'd be, you know, empty beds and then new people. And she said, I have a friend who's the nurse in that ward, and she's been telling me about this man, and he's going to die. And she goes, "Is that your husband?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And she said, "What do you think he needs?" And I said, "Well, these are his symptoms. These are his modalities. Mm-hmm. And I think he needs the remedy called Iris, which has, you know, its primary action is on the pancreas. And then it has some funny, what we call our strange, rare, peculiars, where he aggravates at 2 a.m. And whenever he had pain, he would close his eyes, and I'd ask him why. And he said, "Well, if I close my eyes and I'm not nauseous, so I can handle the pain better." And so she said, "Perfect. We'll start him on Iris 200. So I went back to the hospital. I started administering Iris 200 in a liquid potency, and he was discharged 10 days later.
What is Iris? Is it a...
Iris is a flower remedy.
Okay.
Iris, the flower.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So remedies, the same as all Western medicines, are made from plants, animals, right. Diseased tissue, like, right. You know, and toxic substances, minerals. Yeah.
Wow. So I can't help but say to you that you have been in so many different situations in your life where you have had a great pivot. But more importantly, now you're describing two very critical moments where you saved your own life at the last moment. And here you are with your husband after a lot of your own soul searching, a lot of your own discovery, a lot of your own awareness, both on the spiritual as well as the medical wellness journey. And you, at the last moment, use what you know to be right, know to be true, and save his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was amazing.
Makes you pretty special and very onto something, Adele. I can only imagine how your clients feel working with you when they're in your presence or in your hands, so to speak, because I know that that's not always true that we're in front of one another, but the ability to zero in and pay that close attention and be that plugged in and have that much awareness for others, not, you know, after learning it for yourself, is, it's just tremendous. I think we talk and read and hear a lot about it, but to actually have it and possess it is just, it's a game changer, and it's much different.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But then again, I couldn't make a living.
You were saving lives instead of making a living.
And I realize the language now, I couldn't make a living, mm-hmm. is stopping me from making a living.
Right.
Conscious thought, right?
Right.
We are what we think. So with that, I had a girlfriend, if we have time for this.
Yes.
Who was living on the streets. She had actually been the influence to take me to Whistler to work in that first spa. She's a powerful person, but her life unraveled. And here she was living on the streets of Whistler with a two-year-old child. And I owned a home. I was only in it 4 days a week. And so I said to her, you need to come and live in my house. And she was there for a few months. And then my husband and I decided we need to consolidate our lives and we need to sell our home. And she bolted. And so again, I went and found her and I said, the house isn't sold yet. You need to stay in the house or you need to go home to Australia where you have family that can support you. Mm-hmm. And I will get you there. Mm-hmm. So I had airline flight points. And I got her on a plane and she went back to Australia where she turned her life around. And now she's considered one of the top 10 coaches in the world.
Wow.
Her story is powerful, but she came back maybe about 4 or 5 years after this. And she looked me up and she had written a book. I think it's called Climbing Mount Everest in Sandals. And she had put a little thank you in there for being one of the people that helped change her life. Mm-hmm. But she told me about coaching. Mm-hmm. She said, Adele, what makes me a great coach is I have the case-taking skills for homeopathy. I understand the mind-body connection, and this is an important part of me being such a powerful coach that's able to change people's lives. You need to go get your coaching ticket. And she said, and do it. Do it. And so that started me now doing this. And then part of coaching was NLP. And it's funny how, you know, we really do draw people towards us with what our focus on. So the people that started coming into my life were people that were coaches, people that were NLP practitioners, people that brought awareness to this powerful manifestation, transformation aspect of our humanity. And then I became, I dropped into NLP, neurolinguistics programming.
That's how it works, right? You just,
that's how it works.
That's how the pathways open.
Mm-hmm. And that came full circle because then I understood the reasons behind my survival. I understood how the subconscious brain worked, and right. I told my story.
And that's when you were able to finally start sharing what actually happened. Well, because it all made sense. The more you were able to make sense of that, not just that you went through something and that you survived something, but all that occurred within it, NLP was able to really, I would imagine, illuminate the experience in a way that you had not had to that point.
NLP is one of those amazing forms of energetic scientific combinations mm-hmm. that can transform people's lives. And it is my greatest joy. And I want people to understand that removing pain, whether it's stress, emotional baggage, emotional pain from your body, healing yourself, doesn't have to be difficult and it doesn't have to be painful. This is how our bodies work, scientifically proven if you need that. But it is an amazing, powerful form of changing the direction of our body, mind, and soul.
Right.
And this is where I really find my joy. And when you do, and I find my purpose, my story brought me here. Took me a while to get here, but now I know this is my purpose. And there's nothing that will shake me from this now. And that is, I think, what people have to sort of grasp is, you know, life takes us on this journey. But when we are on purpose, you ever see that picture of a lighthouse with the wave, the guy's standing in the window with his coffee cup and he's kind of leaning against the doorway and this powerful wave comes like 40 feet above his head and right. you can feel the force of Mother Nature, of whatever you want to call it, hate, you know, bad thoughts.
Right. All the negativity.
Right? You want to give the metaphor, right?
Right.
And he's the calm within the storm. He is the foundation. He is the lighthouse that is unmoving.
Right.
And that is purpose.
Yes.
That is the power behind purpose. You cannot be swayed. No matter what crashes down around you, you realize that you are on purpose. And there's work to be done. And yes. So you are the lighthouse. You're the beacon, and just stay. Yeah. And that thought just came to me. So it's a new thought for me, but I believe when it comes from that area of just truth of and understanding that, yeah, when you find your purpose, you will not waver. You will not turn away from it.
No, you can stand strong. That's right. No, it's never about money. It's always about being truthful and being one with yourself and accepting and embracing it. Because it's like you live in truth then.
Totally.
No one can take that away from you.
Yeah. And I don't believe that the money won't come. I believe that it's part of the equation of just being open to receiving.
That's right.
And that full circle is a part of that entire trajectory of self-reward, gratification.
That's right.
Of just being what you were meant to be on this planet and doing what you're meant to do on this planet.
I love it. I love your story. I love that it came full circle. And I love that you were able to take really along the way, as I see it, it was always... there were always seeds being planted out there and there was always a bit of rain just to keep it going and growing. And at every turn, you were able to continue like harvesting from all corners and bring all those parts in. And now, of course, create it and set it up in such a way that makes sense and that allows you to be your own lighthouse, if you will. So this has been an amazing opportunity to talk to you and to get more understanding as to what you do. And obviously, you can be found to do this work one-to-one with people. I want to make sure we don't lose any chance for folks out there to find you and the best ways in which for them to learn more about the work that you do do. So tell us where to find you, social channels.
Sure. I have a website called lifecoachadele.com.
Okay.
My email is yes@lifecoachadele.com.
I love that.
I do have a Facebook page, which is I Am Your Destiny Coach, which is an older Facebook page. I'm on Instagram, Adele Anderson. I think maybe Adele Anderson Coach. I'll give you the links in your info.
Yes.
I have my LinkedIn, my Instagram.
We will put them in the show notes for everybody to find you and see, because I think that, you know, the big part here is like, how do you navigate life? When do you get the opportunity to, you know, sort of save yourself in a sense, and then take all of that new understanding and plug it into something bigger and better than yourself. So you've clearly done that more than one time.
There's one other thing I'd want to share with clients.
Yes, please.
Or just with our listeners, is that there was something that I learned from that plane crash. I didn't become aware of it right away, but when I started telling my story, just like I, you know, came up with the thought that we are a lighthouse when we are on purpose, is that even in life's most dire circumstances, out of breath, out of time, we still have the ability to make choices for ourselves. And I truly know that to be true. If I would have used the words, I can't get out, my brain wouldn't have sourced that image of a movie that I'd watched. I know that is scientific fact of how our brain works. Mm-hmm. Our subconscious brain's only purpose is to keep us alive physiologically and do exactly what we ask. So when we use words like, I can't, I'm not good enough, I don't know how, our brain believes us. And all of the information that we have downloaded from the moment we become conscious into our subconscious brain is available to us like a library. And there are ways that we can learn how to access that and have the power of that mind every single day. And that's where what I want to leave with the listeners is, never consider that you do not have choice. There's always a limited or an unlimited amount of choices, or a minimum of two, no matter what your circumstances is.
Right.
You can choose to stay where you are, or you can choose something different.
Right. Excellent, excellent place to end. And as I like to say, that is dreams and detours. Having choice, making the choice. And so with that, I thank you for being on the show today. It has been a pleasure to get to know you further and deeper, and we hope that you'll come back.
I will. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. That's it for this episode of Dreams and Detours. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe, and share it with your friends. You can find me at dreamsdetours.com. and at Dreams Detours on Instagram. Thanks for listening.